Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder. I'm the founder of The Morning Pulse and your host for the next 60-plus issues as we analyze the issues related to retirement markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, social media, so much more. We're the only show that brings together academia, financial services, and the media to discuss all these issues. Can't wait to jump in this week. We have a great special guest, Bing Walder from Cerulli Associates. They're a research consulting analytics firm. It's going to be weighing in on recent research about open multiple employer plans. Can't wait for you to hear it. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of The Weekly Pulse. Well, we're going to kick things off this week talking about technology. And joining me on the line is our tag team, our Southern Connection, Dan Klein, Natalie Walters, both joining us from The Motley Fool. Guys, how are you?
Doing well.
Doing good.
Yeah, how's the weather down in the southern part of the United States?
It is really hot here. It's like 86 today in West Palm Beach.
Oh, wow. And Nat, how's Augusta treating you?
It's real nice. About 75 today. It's great.
Wow. Well, good for you guys. So, let's start off with you, Dan. So, what's been top of mind for you and the folks and the readers at the Motley Fool this week?
So, this is one of those days where, you know, Amazon reports, and you know there's going to be big stuff in an Amazon report, but usually it's just the numbers. Did they make money? Did something change? In this case, their CFO just kind of snuck in that they've been working on turning Prime 2-day shipping into Prime 1-day shipping.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to take a while to roll out, first in the U.S. and then around the world. But basically, all the orders you used to have to wait, you know, a terrible 2 days before it showed up at your house, you're now going to get in 1 day. And as you might imagine, Walmart and Target stock took an immediate dive in the negative direction.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, American global consumerism, I'm sure, is bowing down. So I don't really understand. How did they sneak this in? I mean, did they say, oh, by matter of fact, we're doing this?
Well, they were asked a question. The CFO was asked a question about the spending forecasts. And he said, oh, yeah, like, you know, we're going to spend about $800 million more because we're going from 2-day shipping to 1-day shipping. Like, this is the kind of thing that, like, Apple would have a press conference and, like, U2 would be there. And,
yeah,
like, you know, it would be introduced by Michael Buffer. Like, Amazon just kind of casually went, like, hey, you know that thing you spent years trying to catch up to us doing, Walmart and Target? Yeah, we're better than that now. So just absolutely stunning.
Well, yeah. Natalie, how do you see it from your point of view?
I was surprised by this because I don't know if you – I mean, this is – I don't have an official survey, but I know for myself, and I had spoken with some friends and family in the past year, and we had noticed that some of our Prime Day shipments were actually late. And I've noticed that really only in this past year. I noticed it happened a few times. And so I thought they were maybe struggling to keep up with the 2-day shipping, just with the volume of orders as more and more people move to online shopping, especially for, you know, repeat products that you can just order from Amazon in bulk. So I was really shocked to see that they feel confident, not only that they already have 2-day shipping under control, but they can go to 1-day.
Yeah, I mean, they're really stepping up the game. If they have, in fact, I mean, how often do FedEx, UPS, do they get things wrong? You know, Amazon, I guess, is kind of held to a higher standard. Now they're going to keep themselves to a higher standard. How does that get measured? It's going to be really interesting.
And let's point out quickly that they've been doing some things behind the scenes to sort of set up for this. They've taken millions of items that were hard to ship and sort of pushed the onus of shipping them back on the suppliers. They've offered people the ability to have an Amazon day, whereas instead of getting the 2-day shipping, you have all your orders delivered in 1 day a week. So they have done some backstage things, but personally, I have noticed that I get some things in 1 day now, and some things just never show up or take much longer than 2 days. So I am a little bit worried about execution, but even if they hit it 75% of the time, you know, and you get it in the second day, I think people are going to be really happy.
Yeah.
You know, probably the weirdest delivery that I had from Amazon was last year. I ordered something for my camera, and it said it'll be arriving in within 4 hours. And I hadn't even selected for it to be shipped that quickly. I was so shocked. And sure enough, I think it was like 2 hours later, I actually got a phone call to my phone. I didn't recognize the number, and I answered. And they said, this is Amazon. We're outside. And so I walked down and very hesitantly down to the street, and there's a van parked outside my apartment, and somebody just hands me a package. They don't even get out of the van. They just hand me the package outside the van, and I'm like, are you Amazon? They said, yes. And I signed a paper, and it was my shipment. It was very bizarre, but it was incredible. It was
that story. 2 hours. That story is also sounds like the beginning of a Taken movie. So, yeah. tad careful with the unmarked vans.
Yeah, guys, real quick, Natalie, what does this do to Walmart, Target, who were coping the challenge, trying to beef up their technology, their ability to interact with retail consumers? Does this again provide more distance? What do you think, Nat?
I do. I think they're probably all thinking, well, great. Now when we just felt like we were catching up, they're always, you know, just another step ahead. And, you know, they have so much power and so much money to keep kind of leapfrogging everybody that it's hard to catch up to Amazon. You know, they're always thinking ahead, and they, like I said, they have the resources to do so. And, you know, so many people are already locked into Amazon Prime, and now it just, you know, confirms for everybody that they're doing the right thing by sticking with Amazon, even though they lifted prices last year. But, you know, that it's worth it, you know, for one day shipping. We're in a culture where, you know, you just want things now, and, you know, it's one day, it'll be, everything will get to us in 2 hours, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I gotta tell you, I hate Amazon's content on their Amazon Prime Video. But with that being said, Natalie, I know content and Netflix and Disney, they're passions of yours. Any news in that arena?
Yes. So I think probably once a year, there's this huge deal where there's a rumor going around that The Office is going to leave Netflix, which is huge because that's always been a top draw on Netflix, because The Office was such a huge hit and it's so easy to rewatch the series. And so that's kind of circled back around this time. But it's more serious this time because, you know, more and more companies are creating their own platforms. And now NBC looks to be doing the same thing, and NBC is in charge of The Office. And so it's just kind of, you know, Netflix is at the top of the game, but people are just starting to think in the future, you know, when, you know, NBC and Disney and all these other companies have their own platform, will Netflix still be the top dog, especially if Netflix can't provide people with these long beloved shows like Friends and The Office that people love rewatching? And so the Wall Street Journal count.
Sorry, go ahead, Nat.
Yeah, the Wall Street, I was just going to mention, the Wall Street Journal count was a report this week. And what's interesting is that even though Netflix has come out with some incredible original shows like Stranger Things that people love and, you know, has really made a mark for Netflix in Hollywood, only two of its top 10 shows last year were originals. And the others were, you know, these really easily rewatchable shows like Friends and The Office. And so if those are gone, that's going to put a real dent in Netflix and will definitely bring down its value.
Yeah, thanks. And Natalie, I do apologize for interrupting you. Sometimes it's hard to you know, have the intuition to figure out when someone's going to end their sentence, so my apologies to you. Daniel, you know, we've been talking about this since you joined the program, all these different groups creating their own sites. How do you see it?
So you've got Disney, and Disney Plus is going to be successful. They have the intellectual property to make it work. You have NBC, which is launching, and I have a lot of doubts about that. I mean, they're close. They have the Comcast library, so maybe. And then you have Time Warner, and they're going to launch too, and that's Friends. But I don't see people buying a service, another service, just because it has a show or two they like. So I think you're going to find that these are all going to be niche things with the exception of Disney. And there's probably going to be a price, if Netflix wants to pay it, where it can license content like Friends that will also be on other services. That's something that Netflix has acknowledged it might be able to do, and it might have to do. about 60% of Netflix viewing is these older shows, but every year that they produce more originals, that becomes the draw. I mean, remember, Netflix's business used to be mailing you DVDs, and now they have hit television shows. Yeah. So I do think Disney is gonna be a blip. It's going to cause some people to leave Netflix, and that's because of Marvel and Star Wars and some of the content that was being licensed to Netflix and is no longer being licensed. But honestly, I think a lot of these services are not going to work, and the companies are going to want the money that they've been getting paid by Netflix.
Yeah. So let me, we got 2 minutes left. I want to give you each a minute. My thesis, the day Daniel joined the program, I said that aggregation, consolidation, people who could aggregate, I asked that question and we never really got back to that answer. So I want you each to take a minute. Natalie, I'll start with you. Is the future, just based on what Daniel's comment was and your comment, is the future in someone coming in and sharing revenue, licensing, and bringing it all in one spot? Because I can tell you for damn sure, I am not buying NBC, Disney, ABC, you name it. I can tell you I'm not doing that. So what do you think, Nat?
I think, you know, not all of them can survive. You know, even look at, you know, I kind of think of the food industry and, you know, all these companies that tried to do the deliverable food, and you know, only the strong have survived. You know, I think only the strong will survive in this industry. I think there will definitely be some sharing of shows, you know, even if Friends, what was that, Warner Media that does Friends, even if they create their platform, you know, they could have Friends on their platform and also share it with Netflix and just cut the fee a bit that Netflix has to pay them for Friends. I think there will definitely be sharing of shows. And, you know, as Dan said, each year Netflix produces more shows, more seasons of beloved shows, and that's going to help it. You know, it's one day it will have its own version of The Office and Friends where, you know, there's 8 to 12 seasons of a beloved show that people can rewatch. You know, Stranger Things 3rd season comes out this year, and that show has been a huge hit. So, you know, each year these companies are going to build up their library and create their own brands, their own beloved shows that
yeah. –
last and have a legacy.
Dan, why don't you take us out. How do you see it? Interesting points from Nat. What's your
take?
Yeah.
So I agree. A lot of these things are going to fail. And wouldn't it be nice if we just had one service where we could pay one bill to one company and get all the television channels we want in one place?
Yeah.
We've been fighting really hard against cable. And what we're going to get back to is for a while we're going to pay 12 different services, and then somebody's going to figure out how to build a new cable bundle. Maybe it'll be T-Mobile, maybe it'll be Apple, but this is getting preposterous, and I don't think people are going to put up with it for that much longer.
Well, there they are, the purveyors of intellectual capital, Natalie Walters, Dan Klein from The Motley Fool. They are our tag team, Southern Connection. Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Interesting, interesting stuff. A lot of lessons there for content providers in the retirement space. Guys, have a wonderful weekend. We'll talk to you very soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. I made a microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Hopping
and Lone Beach together. Now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a welcome back, everyone. Now it's time for our Millennial Money segment. Joining me on the line, on his road trip for the Power of Financial Freedom book, Mr. Grant Sabatier. Grant, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to talk with you. I know you have been traveling, I wouldn't say yet the globe, but you are now outside the United States. Why don't you tell us where you've been and where you are, or where you are and where you've been?
Yeah, so I'm about 6 weeks into the Financial Freedom Book Tour. Went all across North America, up California. Now I'm going across Canada. So I'm in Calgary. I'm just outside Banff National Park. It's super beautiful. And yeah, it's just been an amazing tour so far.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I apologize for getting the name of the book wrong, but it is The Power of Finance, and The Power of Financial Freedom is at the end of the day what we're all striving to get to. So, you know, as you kind of crossed over from the United States into Canada, obviously different Canadians, maybe a little bit different than Americans, any themes that you can identify in terms of, you know, the messaging and things that, you know, the kind of the conversations you've been having with some of them Canadians, eh?
I think, you know, in Canada, they have access to, you know, more social services than we do in the United States. And I've actually met more people who are going to retire in their mid-40s than I ever expected. There's a lot of people who work in like the gas industry. There's a lot of people who, you know, haven't been saddled with student loan debt. And so they start their careers off able to save a lot of money. The most biggest expense here, just like in the U.S., is real estate, but there's some good deals still to be had. But overall, you know, similar sentiment, you know, Canadians want financial freedom, just like people really all across the world. And it's cool to see people from all walks of life and all countries, you know, working towards this, because it really never has been easier to live life on your own terms and retire early if that's your goal.
Yeah. And how have book sales been? I think when we last chatted, you know, Amazon, things were climbing. You were up there, but you were climbing. Anything you can share in terms of those numbers?
Yeah, no, just hit 100,000 books sold worldwide, and it continues to grow. So I'm sitting in like the 1,000 top books of 13 million on Amazon. And so super happy with where that's at, and just excited for it's coming out in 13 languages. So those should start rolling out here in the next couple of weeks. And yes, super pumped for it. I'm also really pumped just how well the U.S. economy is doing generally. A lot of people I know people who've pulled money off the table last fall. Now they're getting back into the market. They missed out on some amazing gains this year, but man, I really don't see a recession in sight. I don't know about you.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk a little bit, in a bit, with Kevin and Oliver on the markets, but from what I saw, great GDP numbers or good GDP numbers at 3.2%. I was going to actually ask you about the gas prices, because I know that you were in California. The last time we chatted about 3 weeks ago, you were in Cali. Gas prices have kind of creeped up. How has that impacted? And you're driving across this great land. So how has that impacted some of your travels? Are you seeing it impact the people that you're interacting with?
Yeah, I mean, gas prices, I mean, they're all relative. I think, you know, for a certain, socioeconomic group, I think obviously a $4 per gallon gas, hits certain groups of people harder than it does others. For me, it's just a 25% unexpected increase on travel costs, but it's still, you know, I'm driving all across the country and Canada, and it's still only costing about $30 per day to fill my car up, so, or my van up. And so often, you know, it's very expensive in this country, in the United States, to be poor. And so that 25% makes a massive difference, you know, when you're filling a, you know, 15 gallon tank, you know, $15 more, you know, really, really hurts a lot of people's pocketbooks. Not having a huge impact on me, but certainly, hey, gas is still, you know, $2.20 in the South, and in places in Texas, when I was just outside of Houston, it was like, you know, $2.18 a gallon. So, it's not expensive everywhere, even though obviously we do see the cost going up.
Yeah. And back to your question about recession. I mean, I think we have been trying to talk ourselves into a recession, not me and you and I in particular, but I think there are definitely people who have been articulating. I know I was doing some media maybe three and a half, four years ago and being interviewed, and, you know, people were saying, this is right around the corner, we're going to have a recession. I think invariably when an economy gets overheated, you're going to have pullbacks. Look, I don't think we should be wishing that. I mean, I think, you know, we should be talking ourselves into that. I think we should be talking about being positive and being productive and trying to benefit, having the market benefit all of us. So I'm not really big on thinking that there's going to be a recession in the near future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
So, what's next on tap? How long are you in Canada, and where will you be headed next?
Yeah, actually leaving Canada today and heading down to Denver for an event Saturday night. And so heading back into the States, going to drive, have about an 8-hour drive ahead of me today, and then head across the country. So go from Denver to Nebraska to Iowa, all the way across the Midwest up to Minneapolis, Chicago, and then down to Nashville. So on the road for about a month more, and really excited to finish off the tour strong.
Yeah, and I should also point out, you know, the book is available, financialfreedombook.com. There's also an audiobook. You recorded the audiobook, but you mentioned it's going to be in several languages. Did you? You're a very smart man. Did you record all the different languages that the book is going to be in?
That'd be crazy.
That'd be cool if you could do that, though.
That'd be so nuts. Like, here, I learned Japanese just to record the audiobook. No, just in English. That was enough for me.
Yeah, it was a lot of effort to record the right intonation, inflection. You had to be coached through that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. It took about 6 days. And the audiobook's about 10 hours and 45 minutes. But the cool thing about the audiobook, there's actually about 20% more content than the hardcover book. Simply because they gave me more liberties, and so I could tell more stories and share some more ideas, and that's something that not a lot of people know.
Any more television appearances? As I mentioned last week, the last time we chatted about 2 or 3 weeks ago, you had hit Rachel Ray. You had been on Rachel Ray's show. Any other media appearances that we should be aware about that we can check out on YouTube and other sites?
Yeah, check out just came out yesterday, 60 Second Docs, the International Documentary Film Company did a film on me and the book tour that came out yesterday on YouTube, just 60 Second Docs Wealth. You can check that out. And then, might be an update here in the next couple of shows on some other TV things I have in the works. I actually flew back to New York for 2 days to do some meetings with some networks. And so there's a lot happening. And I'm excited to share that when the time's right. Cross your fingers. And yeah, man, now just focused on finishing off the tour and helping people retire early.
There you go. Well, there he is, Grant Sabatier from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, on his way, on his journey. You can find the book at financialfreedombook.com. It's also available on electronically and on audiobook. Grant Sabatier, always a pleasure talking with you. Safe travels and have some fun in Denver.
Take care, Jeff. Thanks, man. Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And that was a great conversation with Grant Sabatier. He was out on his Financial Freedom book tour, brought up some good points about recession. And now we're going to shift to potential recession, I should say, and really check in with the folks who know the most, at least on our program. We're checking in now in our market segment with Kevin Kelly. He is the co-founder of Delphi Digital, a cryptocurrency research firm, and he's also a former equity strategist. Hey, Kev, how are you, buddy?
What's going on, Jeff?
I'm doing good. It's twice in 1 week I get to see you and talk to you. So
I know. What a treat.
Yeah, well, I don't know. For me, it is. I'm not sure it's much of a treat.
For me, it is as well.
Awesome. I appreciate that. Thanks for making some time for us. So let's talk about GDP number, 3.2%, which I guess exceeds expectations, right? But why don't you break it down for us? Because I think you kind of can unravel the numbers and give us the real facts here.
Yeah, I mean, the headline print, the 3.2, is certainly, you know, well above expectations. And I would look at it almost as a good political print, right? You've already got, you know, President Trump obviously out there on the front lines touting this number. And while it does look good on paper, and it's not necessarily a bad print, but you got to dig under the hood. You know, there are a few things I think that are a bit concerning that could weigh on growth going forward. I mean, the first is kind of looking at consumer spending. You know, consumer is such a large part of the U.S. economy, and you did start to see some weakness in terms of year-over-year growth in consumer spending. You're also starting to see some of the effects of tariffs or maybe indirect effects of tariffs and the tariff announcements last year kind of started to play out in the first quarter numbers, because you had a lot of businesses that essentially, pulled forward or pulled goods from or bought goods from abroad in anticipation of these tariff hikes and raises going up. And so if you think that your imports are going to become more expensive potentially, you saw a lot of that kind of demand pulled forward, you know, at the end of last year. And so imports in this most recent print, you know, pretty much collapsed, which makes a lot of sense if you think about, you know, where we were last year and again with that demand being pulled forward towards the end of last year, Q4. When you saw imports collapse, I mean, that's another thing they were looking for. And then the inflation. I mean, inflation remains, you know, well below the Fed's target, and still remains tepid. And it's tough to see how, you know, we get to tackle the debt problem that continues to rise if you're not able to actually either, you know, inflate it away to a degree or grow out of it. So, you know, the 3.2, it's obviously not anything for concern. The economy's still doing well. It's still growing. But it's certainly something that you don't necessarily need to take at face value.
Yeah. And so, you know, on the tariff front, the import front. I mean, didn't we make nice now with China? Haven't we kind of put aside some of our differences? I seem to recall reading that. I don't know if that really – we probably have differences in other areas, intellectual property, technology. But I seem to recall during the week that there were some articles about maybe making nice on this tariff issue.
Yeah, and there's going to be – I mean, it depends on obviously who you talk to. I definitely think we're a lot closer than we were, you know, even, you know, 2 or 3 months ago. And I think we will – I think a deal is certainly inevitable, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the markets after that happens, because I think part of the recent rally, you know, this year was one – you had a terrible fourth quarter, as we've talked about, you know, a number of times, the worst in a decade for stocks. That rebound was kind of fueled by central banks, you know, Jerome Powell turning around saying, you know, we're not going to hike interest rates in 2019, kind of gave the market a little bit of relief there. You also had some, I would say, more optimistic expectations for when a trade deal can get done between the U.S. and China. You know, we obviously haven't signed, sealed, and delivered anything yet, but I do think that, you know, we're getting closer and closer to that point. And the question then becomes how much of that is really priced into a market, you know, that's now trading, you know, close and broke above to new all-time highs this week.
Yeah. And then what do we make about some of the other emerging markets? I mean, what I read from the International Monetary Fund and other big, you know, big central bankers is that that is definitely slowing in the emerging and developing countries. I mean, that obviously – or global growth is slowing. That obviously will impact us potentially.
Yeah. No, it's – I don't think the U.S. can certainly operate in ice – a bit in isolation in that it can go on for a bit and maybe not get dragged down by some of these more emerging economies, but they can't diverge forever. And, you know, to your point, I mean, the IMF came out, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago with their new economic outlook. And you can see that their global growth expectations, again, they still sit for world economic output above 3% for 2019, but they've come down pretty handily over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months. And it is a lot of those kind of emerging economies that are expected that have higher growth rates or expected growth rates. The acceleration of those, or I should say the deceleration of those, has come down quite a bit compared to the advanced economies, which again I think is a reason why people have flooded to the U.S. equity market, because when you look at kind of when all the chips are down, the U.S. is actually positioned, you know, pretty well compared to, you know, the volatility that you might get in some of the underlying economic data coming out of other countries.
So it's earnings season, Kevin, and one of the things I love when talking to you and Oliver is that you guys know so much about so much, and you know, we had 3M disappointing yesterday. That's Thursday. Today's Friday when we're recording. But 3M disappointing, the Dow taking a little bit of a beating. How is earnings season looking thus far?
You know, overall, this is another thing that I think, you know, you need to dig into and not really take it face value. If you looked at it, you know, from a very high level, earnings season's actually been pretty good. And one of the big catalysts or reasons for that is because when you think about, again, why the U.S. really the equity market fell off in the fourth quarter, a lot of it was because analysts were coming out and revising down their estimates for, you know, corporate profitability across the board. And so basically what we had was a situation where in the first quarter, you know, expectations were almost so low that, you know, it gave a lower bar for these companies to beat, right? So on paper, everything looks like we're having a, you know, pretty solid solid earnings season here with a number of different major companies in major industries, you know, beating analyst estimates. But what I'm looking for and watching for is kind of the commentary and the guidance that some of these companies have come out with. And a lot of it has been, you know, pretty decently positive. But again, it's something you don't want to necessarily just take at face value and look at a high level, because you got to think about where we were, you know, 6 months ago, where those expectations were, how far they've come down. And that's kind of the bar that's been set for some of these companies. So I think that, you know, looking out to the second half of 2018, I think estimates are still a little bit, I would say, optimistic there. So it's going to be definitely interesting as we get, you know, maybe not in the second quarter, but third and fourth quarter of this year, you know, how stocks react.
Yeah. So let's shift gears. Crypto, that's right in your bailiwick today. What's the latest news? I was just, you know, as an aside, you know, I look at news every day. Two things that really struck my fancy that I'm looking at closely, want to get your feedback on. The New York Attorney General alleges that a cryptocurrency exchange hid losses of $850 million. How do you hide $850 million?
It's not easy, and eventually the everything comes out in the wash, right? It catches up to you. Yeah. The kind of high level on that is one of these exchanges is also operates with a stable coin called Tether, or the ticker's USDT, that anybody out there who's familiar with crypto is probably familiar with. It's the largest and arguably the most traded stable coin out there. And what I mean by stable coin is it's tied or pegged to the US dollar. And so basically there's this kind of whole dramatic situation where the exchange itself had money with a third party kind of payment provider that money was allegedly seized, and so there was some back and forth about that $850 million that was seized. Was it actually seized? Did the principals of the third party that was holding that money actually just go off and commit fraud and just take it? There's still a lot of debate there, but essentially what ended up happening was the exchange itself actually went to the reserves of that stable coin, right? Because if you have a stable coin that's backed one for one to the US dollar, you have to have the reserves for every single stable coin that you print, right? It has to be one for one backed by the US dollar. And so basically leverage those reserves to try and kind of hide this or kick the can down the road a bit, because they had clients coming in and asking for withdrawals off their exchange, and they weren't able to fund those because their liquidity was obviously extremely tight. So it kind of became this whole charade that's now coming out in the wash. And as you mentioned, there's a pretty decently sized court filing. I think it's like 23 or 25 pages that anybody can read about, that was filed yesterday by the New York Attorney General. And so it's definitely something that a lot of people are skeptical about. This isn't the first time that this exchange or Tether has been in the news. But it's also something that I don't think a lot of people knew the extent of. I mean, myself included, didn't know what kind of the great extent this would be. So it's definitely shocked a lot of people. But I would say what's interesting is that you saw a pretty decent leg down in Bitcoin and crypto markets, last night when the news came out, right after the news. A really, really deep, kind of deep plunge, almost 10-15% for some of these things. But then we've kind of rebounded back recently, which, again, it's only 24 hours after, and we'll see, how far this goes and if the investigation obviously will go further. There's going to be more that kind of comes out about this as time goes on. But I think we're almost getting to that point again in the crypto market where some of this may have been a bit priced in, and people are looking at this and saying, okay, maybe the systematic risk that we thought this would create really isn't that bad because people can move off of exchanges. And yes, there's probably going to be some serious losses for some investors, but it kind of, short term might be bearish for crypto, but long term, pretty bullish for crypto because you start to wait out some of these kind of bad actors that are honestly, these types of situations are what hold institutions back from this market because it still is, the Wild West as much as we want to think that it's not.
Yeah, but does it, we have a fractional reserve system for banks because banks lend out money. As you were describing that, and again, I am not a banking expert and I'm certainly not an expert on crypto. But when you're talking about a stable coin pegged to the US dollar and people were coming looking for money, I kind of liken it to a run on a bank. Right. So you've got a fractional reserve system. So banks typically don't keep all the money that is deposited. They lend it out and that's how they're able to pay interest. Right. There's a cost to doing that. And I'm wondering, is that something that could be in the offing for crypto, something like this quote unquote stable coin that you're describing?
Yeah, so it's definitely a really good way to think about it too. And when you think about the fractional reserve banking system as it exists today, a lot of the money that's created, right, is no longer really actual cash and physical coins and things of that nature. It's actually created by some of these commercial banks with their lending practices and things like that, right? So if you had people who made a run on a bank, it wouldn't necessarily be like the early 20s where you would have like a bank run and there'd be no shortage of cash. The commercial banks themselves can actually kind of create money. But to that point, this is one of the things that a lot of people in the crypto markets and crypto enthusiasts have been very, very much against, especially when it comes to something like Bitcoin, where they say, their argument is against kind of the fractional reserve banking system and all of the things that, could potentially go wrong with that. It's looking at something as more kind of sound hard money, and it's not, fiat currency that you could, print kind of at will. and devalue at will, similar to what, you know, a central bank of the treasury can do.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely an interesting comparison. And with the stable coin, again, it's the whole point of it is to be backed by the US dollar, right? So it kind of helps. It's a gateway for people to come into crypto and maybe trade Bitcoin, but trade back into this, you know, stable coin US dollar. And if that's not, you know, fully backed, then when you go to withdraw or when you go to actually, you know, claim your funds, you know, the fact that it's not there is certainly spooked, you know, scared a lot of people.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin Kelly, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for giving us literally around the globe, up and down look at the markets this week. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Always my pleasure, Jeff.
Talk to you soon.
You too, man.
Bye. Welcome back. And, you know, in this segment, this is our guest segment. We've got a very special guest. We're going to talk again about some retirement research. Very important. Last week, we had a great segment with Dr. Michael Finca. This week, we are joined, by Bing Waldert. He is the managing director at U.S. Research at the consulting, research, and analytics firm Cerulli Associates. Bing, how are you, my friend?
Good. Thank you for inviting us.
Well, thank you. You guys always have some great research, and our show is about retirement and about savings, and research is a big part of that. We want to be sharing this great information you all come up with. So let's start with what's some of the latest research that you all at Cerulli have gathered? Because you guys are doing – you're in a lot of areas – you know, you're doing a lot of analytics, a lot of information. So what's been top of mind for you all?
Yeah, I think what's been interesting is Spark hired us, Spark, which is, as you know, the trade association for record keepers, hired us late last year to do a project and look into, you know, what is the outlook for MEPs, multi-employer plans. And this was really spurred by, you know, potential executive orders, potential legislation in and around this topic of MEPs. And so what we did is we did a survey of about 400 small business owners and asked them, you know, how do you feel about your retirement plan? If you don't have a retirement plan, would you be interested in this MEP construct? And likewise, if you already do have a retirement plan, would you be interested in switching to this MEP construct? And I think the findings from that were fairly interesting. I think what we found is, you know, first of all, small business owners, based on the description of the MEP concept, they weren't necessarily overwhelmingly to the point where they would look to switch to a MEP. But if they were to switch to a MEP, I think that, you know, both those who have a plan now, but also those who don't have a plan, you know, the common theme that cascaded through that was, make it very, very easy for me to do. If you can take something off my plate as a small business owner, that's what would get me to take action. The second thing I would say, and I think this was a fairly surprising finding to us, is overwhelmingly they trusted the financial services industry over other potential providers of MEPs. In that we asked them about the various functions you would classically associate with a retirement plan, but also who would you expect to do this? And we tested that against, again, large financial services companies, associations, and then finally the government. And what we found is that there's a fairly strong distrust of government as a provider of these plans.
Very, very interesting. And just for the benefit of the audience, this multiple employer plan construct is designed to help provide retirement plan coverage. We've talked about it in other segments of the show. This is a critical issue. There are tens of millions of Americans who do not currently have a workplace retirement plan. They need coverage because they don't have a way to offer retirement benefits economically and at lower cost. So this is a solution proposed by the industry. Very, very interesting, very attractive, and I wouldn't say a competitor, but there are other solutions out there, one by the state retirement state plans kind of offering something similar. So Bing, very interesting, and I love this research. I've specifically talked to a lot of smaller employers as I'm out on the road talking to clients, et cetera. And, you know, some of the biggest things I'm interested in your findings, maybe drilling down a little bit more, is some of the concerns is, you know, the fiduciary responsibility of offering a retirement plan, right? I mean, that is a huge responsibility. It's a legal responsibility. You're actually personally liable for offering a retirement plan and being able to, like you said, make it easy for someone to kind of bolt on a retirement plan to their program for their employees is really important.
Yeah, and I think one of the survey audiences that we talked to, and actually I think it was those who didn't offer a plan. They, you know, where they were most concerned about offering a plan was fiduciary duty. But I think what we are seeing a more educated consumer of financial services in the U.S. in general. But I guess I would take that finding with a grain of salt in that. I don't think the average small business owner truly understands what it means to be a fiduciary in a retirement plan. And so I think fiduciary almost in that case comes out as code for, again, make this easy for me. Mm-hmm. Take the risk out, take the risk off your table. And I think to your earlier point too, I think this coverage gap is in part what makes this project somewhat exciting, right? It's that coverage gap is really most pronounced, to your point, with small employers, right? It's someplace between 40% and 50% of employees who work for a business with less than 100 employees don't have access to a retirement plan today. And so I think one of the things that I found very exciting about this project is it's you know, the retirement market in the U.S. and frankly the entire asset management market is at a fairly mature point, and it's really one of the few white space opportunities in both the retirement and the asset management market right now.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And for many people who are not in the industry, like Bing and myself, if you're just a layperson in a different field, we've got a lot of cost containment that's going on. There's fee compression. That makes and you can see, if you look from the outside, you can see some consolidation happening. Wells Fargo recently sold its business to Principal. There's many others, and that's really just a function of the maturation of the industry. But I really love, just back to the MEPS for a second, I love really great ideas, and I love, you know, solutions. And I think you're right. I think we need to do a lot of education. I think that's really something that we will never, ever end. We need to educate employers about what the options are, what's available to them, what the words like fiduciary mean. But we also need to educate employees, because even if a MEP is offered, for example, by an employer, small business owner, we still got to get employees into these plans. And we can do things like auto enrollment, auto escalation, assigning QDIAs. But people really should, and those things are great, and we want them, but we want to make sure that people are also educated as well, because they got to use the plan. The plan's only as good as people use it, right?
No, absolutely, and I would make two points here. I think the first one, right, is, you know, there was this, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this fairly steep distrust of the government as a retirement plan provider. But I think to your point, you know, we've seen features like auto escalation, like auto enrollment, like, you know, the appointing of the target date fund as a QDIA. What we've seen is that, you know, the easier and the more frankly automatic and mandatory you make it for people, the better results you're going to get in terms of retirement savings. And so I think the advent of the state run plans is emerging as kind of a key cog in closing some of that retirement savings coverage gap. But I think those state-run plans that have been successful are those that are pairing that kind of mandate for participation with education. They're doing it in stages. They're, you know, baking in a fairly significant outreach component to the small employers of the state. It's not just a mandate; it's a mandate plus that educational piece. The second point I would make is relative to the open MEP concept, and I think one of the key questions I would really have relative to the potential success or failure of open MEPs is, who's going to sell this, right? Who is going to do that education? And who is that, who is going to go, you know, small business owner by small business owner by small business owner and get them to enroll in open MEPs? You know, one of our kind of key theses at Cerulli is that we are expecting the wealth management industry, the full service wealth management industry, to start to shrink. So it's hard to imagine who that financial advisor is who's going to go out and ultimately promote these open MEPs. But I think my point is, overall, is I think that education component, to your point, is one of the key parts of closing that retirement gap. We can create solutions as an industry, but we have to educate small business owners and potential participants as to the advantages.
Absolutely. And I love this research. Can you, in the last couple of minutes, you know, I did a little bit of an intro. I should have allowed you to talk a little bit about what you're doing at Cerulli. I know you do a lot of research, a lot of analytics, a lot of consulting. Do you want to spend a couple minutes talking about the firm, but also some of the things that you're thinking about? Because you probably are managing other research projects as well. And we'd love to hear for what you can share, because I know probably some of it's top secret or classified, and we don't want you to get in trouble. Could you mind sharing a little bit about what you guys are thinking about for the future?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So, as you mentioned, we are a market research and we're a consulting firm. We're fairly unique for two reasons. I think first of all, our sole focus is the asset management, wealth management, and retirement industries. It's all that we do. We're also unique in that we are in fact a global firm. So we have a fully staffed. We're headquartered in Boston. We also have fully staffed offices in both London and Singapore. But one of the things I think we probably take the most pride in is that we are still a fully independent firm. Kurt Cerulli founded the firm 26 years ago. Kurt Cerulli is still the sole owner. And I think that gives us a really unique position to act as a truly independent observer of the industry. To your point as to what are we thinking about more broadly? I think some of the trends that you've surfaced. What's interesting is what's happening in the retirement industry is really reflective of what's going on. Every place else in the U.S. asset management industry right now. You mentioned consolidation of record keepers. We're seeing consolidation of almost every other type of buyer of asset management products, broker dealers, independent RIAs, investment consultants, and OCIOs, and record keepers as part of that. This idea of fee compression is happening almost every place in the asset management and wealth management market. Asset managers have very much seen this fee compression start to impact their business. Investment consultants are being asked to provide more services for a lower price. But the one place we haven't seen that fee compression come to play yet is actually into the retail wealth management market. And so I think what we're seeing though is this almost expectation of more services at a lower price. No matter who is providing that service to the buyer of asset management products. The final point I would make too is this. I would call it fiduciary awareness, right? I don't know that you could get into a group of affluent investors and that any of them could actually define what a fiduciary is. But I do think that you have consumers of asset management products who are much more aware of some of the conflicts of interest classically associated with our industry. And so I do think they are making better decisions and more aware decisions about who they choose to do business with. But we are seeing that much more educated consumer of financial services products.
Yeah. Well, certainly a lot to research, a lot to talk about. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Hopefully this is just a start of sharing some additional research as you guys develop it. We'd love to have you back. It's really important. The granularity, the specifics, the examples, that really helps, I think, in people's minds kind of formulate their own game plan. So we thank you very much for joining us and enjoy Boston this week. And hopefully you guys get some great weather. I know it was raining a little bit today.
Yeah, no, the Red Sox game was canceled last night, unfortunately.
Go Sox and enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks again for inviting me.
Thanks, Bing. Bye-bye. Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble. Captain and Lone Beach together. Now you know you. Welcome back, and that was certainly an interesting interview with Bing Waller about the latest financial research in the financial services industry. So now let's turn our attention to our personal finance and retirement segment. Joining me on the line, and I'm seeing her for the second time this week, Miss Allie Melito. She is the retirement reporter covering the retirement beat for MarketWatch. Hi, Allie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Really great to see you and Jacob this week. Thanks so much for coming to the studio. What is top of mind? What has been on the top of mind for you, the folks at MarketWatch, and your readers?
So one thing I actually just published a couple of hours ago was about state-sponsored retirement plans. I am just so interested in the concept of states getting involved in helping people with retirement planning. And New Jersey recently had gotten their bill signed to offer this auto IRA plan, which Oregon, California, and Illinois have done. And I talked to some people about what might be next for the states. So a few things that have happened so far, just in case anybody doesn't know, states are getting involved in retirement planning by offering the private workforce retirement account. It's an IRA, individual retirement account, and it is administered by the state, but they work with a financial services firm, And it's really targeted for small businesses who don't offer these sorts of plans, like a 401k or whatever, to employees, just to get people to save. So in some cases, they mandate that these businesses, if they have a certain number of employees, say 25 or 50, that they offer a plan. And then in other cases, it's just voluntary. Like, it's just there for them if they can't afford to administer a 401k of their own, that they would like to help their employees save a retirement. So Oregon was the first state to do that, followed by Illinois and California. And in each of those scenarios, there has been pushback, sometimes even lawsuits. So California actually just won their lawsuit recently because there are people who are against these plans, and they say that it's because these plans infringe upon ERISA, which is the law that oversees private workforce retirement plans and how they're administered. The court decision was basically that California, Cal favors their program, does not preempt that law. So they're good to go. They're legal all as well. I spoke with people after that, and they said that this is really a good sign for those who, those states that were interested in a plan, but were afraid of the legal issues. And then, so I did that story, and I followed up just to see what might be next, like who might be next. And some experts told me that Washington State and Hawaii are probably the most likely to get something passed June, or sooner rather than later. And then there are a few other states in the works. They either have agreed to something, like New Jersey, New York, or they are close. They're on the Congress floor currently voting. But still, there are so many people and so many groups that are against these plans, which is interesting because at the end of the day, these plans, the states say it's to help people who don't have retirement accounts. But those who are against it do have good arguments. They say that, you know, these plans might not have the best investment options. You know, they might have more basic investment options, whereas other financial services firms might give them more choices for how they invest their portfolios. Other people say that states and government just should not be involved in something like this because it's kind of competing with the private companies out there. And then, of course, people still think that it's not 100% legal because ERISA is overseeing private workforce retirement accounts, and this is something that, at the end of the day, is for the private workforce.
Right. So you have, I mean, you know, the state-run, I understand the arguments, and I guess, you know, the industry itself, the retirement industry, has lobbied hard. And as you know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know because you cover this on a regular basis, but the SECURE Act, or whatever it's going to be called in the Senate and the House, they have an act that they're going through, will establish multiple employer plans. So the industry has been focused on that as a solution. But, you know, state-run plans are really a quasi-public and private because the administration is being done, I think, as you said in your earlier comments, by a financial services organization. So, you know, I don't know. Is it a function of someone wanting an organization or organizations wanting to have more control? You know, just to give the audience an idea, there's over $28 trillion in U.S. retirement assets. That's IRAs, pensions, defined contribution, which are like 401k plans, SEPs, KEOs, et cetera. That's a lot of money in play, and conceivably it's only going to be more as people begin to save more, and doesn't include things like Social Security, et cetera. You know, what's your sense, Allie, in terms of some of the pushback that you've been hearing when you're talking to some of the experts you interview?
So, I mean, I understand their arguments, and they also say something like, well, these are IRA plans. You know, bottom line, they're IRA plans, which people can open up by themselves. They don't need an employer to open an IRA like they do need an employer to open a 401k. The problem is people don't do it. If you don't have a 401k and you're not thinking about retirement saving, you may not save for retirement. And what the states are trying to do is, one, get more companies on board to offer some sort of retirement benefit to employees, but they're also trying to get people to just automatically be enrolled in these accounts and therefore, contribute every paycheck to have something at the end of their career when they're ready to retire. And there have been numerous studies, and Richard Thaler, who was is a Nobel Prize winner in behavioral economics. They, you know, all of these different researchers have shown that when you have somebody who kind of does the work, the beginning work for you, you're more likely to stay involved in the retirement account. So if you don't have to set up the retirement account and you don't even have to withdraw money from one account and deposit into another account, you're more likely to stay in that account.
Yeah.
That's not always the best thing because, you know, if you stay at one type of contribution rate, you might not increase so that you don't end up having enough at retirement, you know, when it's time to retire. But at least you have something and you, you know, in the back of the mind, you do know that you are saving for something. And so you can contribute more or less as time goes on.
Yeah. And look, I think, you know, we've talked about this online and offline on the show, from the show. And, you know, I think we need to have these auto features. We need to have people, we need to have them because I think it gets people into the program. But I mean, I think you make a great point. And I'm at a conference this week or late this week. Someone made the point that, you know, the Pension Protection Act established auto enrollment. The most employers default people in at 3%. People don't. Mm-hmm. People who are defaulted in don't necessarily change from the default, assuming that what their employer gave them or provided to them in the original default is what they need to do, right? So, or 6% or 3% with a 3% match if you work for an employer that matches. But I think the lesson here is that these things are great tools. At the end of the day, and I think you and Jacob and others are great advocates for this, is people need to be educating themselves. Need to be educated. The American people need to understand why it's important to save, you know, and not rely on just someone to, whether it's a state, whether it's a quasi-private public, whether it's, you know, whatever I can't even think of now. But people need to be engaged in thinking about their future because at the end of the day, that ultimately they have they're going to pay the ultimate price.
Yeah, and I think states also, they're not necessarily – so I've spoken with some of the executives of these various state plans, and they've said that this is just the starting point. They're offering a starting point. And companies, if they don't want to work with the government to offer these plans, they're not mandating that they work with the state government's plan. They're mandating that there be something offered to employees, which means that the businesses can then move on and go to a financial services firm that is separate from the state and offer a plan. So, when I talked to some of the executives, they say, like, oh, we, you know, if you don't want to work with us, we give us fine. Work with whoever you want, partner with whoever you want. Just, you know, the end of the day, save, you know, help your employees save for retirement, which, you know, it's commendable.
Yeah, and let's not forget Social Security, which is not really a insurance program. It is a mandate because we are, for many people, there are some employees at government that do not participate in that. But for the majority of Americans, they are mandated to contribute to that plan. So there is precedent for that, but I guess a lot more work to be done. It's good to see solutions being offered. You know, I think it's healthy to have a good conversation and debate about what is the best solution. But you know, we tend to be moving in the right direction. The American retirement system is certainly far from perfect, but these are little patchwork quilts. It's like really a patchwork quilt of solutions. So more to come on that. Allie, always a pleasure. Great seeing you and Jacob this week. Thanks so much for joining us again on the show. I think you've probably had enough of me. But wishing you and Jacob a really great weekend, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Give me the microphone first so I can bust like a bubble.
Captain and Lone Beast together, now you know you in trouble. Welcome back, and now we're going to close out the show with one of our favorite and most well-liked segments, the Legal Eagles segment. Join me on the line. So one of the Eagles is flying, but the other Eagle just landed, David Levine. He's a principal with Groom Law Group. Hey, David, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for landing, and we appreciate you joining us. So tell me, what's top of mind this week for you, the folks at Groom Law Group, the Legal Eagles?
Sure. Top of mind this week is one of our favorite topics. We've talked about cybersecurity and data issues. But there was a settlement this week that we think is worth mentioning. It's important to remember that settlements are not law. They're not the Congress telling us something or the DOL or IRS telling us something. But there was a settlement in the Vanderbilt 403B case lawsuit. And you may be saying, well, that's great. There are settlements all the time. Why this one? And the reason why is there's actually a discussion in there. As some of you may remember, there was the Northwestern case, which was dismissed, where one of the large plaintiff's lawyers was asserting that the use of plan data was a concern, is a nice way to put it. Yeah. And similarly, that same issue was raised in the Vanderbilt case. The Northwestern case got dismissed, but the Vanderbilt case settled. And in the settlement, there are two kind of key things. Number one, Vanderbilt is supposed to tell its current record keeper that they can't use information about plan participants that they've learned about as part of providing record keeping services to market or sell products unrelated to the plan participants unless there's a request from the participant. And knowing that there's a lot of things going on out there right now about, well, how are you using data and what's in connection with the plan and what's not, there's a lot of discussion. The fact that there's this provision in the settlement means that we'll probably see the plaintiff's lawyers bring this up again.
Yeah.
And this is something that if you're a plan fiduciary, you should be thinking, well, what does this mean and how I relate to my service providers? And if you're a service provider, well, how are we going to address this? Because we know the plaintiff's lawyers will be back. Again, it doesn't mean it's a legal standard, but at the same time, we know that now the plaintiff's lawyers are going down this road. We may see it again. Similarly, there's a second part, just like this, about that if they go out, to a future record keeper, they need to contractually prohibit this type of activity. And it'll be interesting because if you look at different size plans, the contracting process is very different and just how it works. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. So if you're a plan sponsor, think about it. And if you're a service provider, how are you going to address this? It doesn't mean it's binding, but it's something to think about.
Yeah. And I know you and Kevin have talked about this. We've talked about data management, cybersecurity, data breaches in other segments of our show. This is kind of a new frontier, right? I mean, people have data on participants on what employees are doing, and theoretically it could be used by other sides of these big organizations to sell auto insurance or sell car insurance or sell some other type of a product. So certainly that's going to be a concern because you don't want your privacy breached. And as someone like myself who has, you know, I've negotiated plenty of record keeping contracts on behalf of clients. And one of the things that always comes up if you have people on site from the record keeping organization is what are they going to talk about? What aren't they going to talk about? And so clients are often concerned about, are they going to be talking about other types of investment products or other type of products? So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I agree. You're more the expert than I am, but I think this is probably the scratching of the surface with this type of issue.
Agreed. And I think with more and more convergence of wellness, financial health, and just the convergence of our society, we're going to have more and more discussions, and we're just a tangential part of the bigger discussion when you talk about the big tech privacy issues, and all that gets sorted out, but we're going to be part of this ride as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you jumping off the plane and, from a business meeting and meeting with us. I mean, this is obviously a really important issue, very topical. The Vanderbilt case, certainly not like any other case out there. A new horizon, new frontier. Enjoy your weekend, David. Give my best to Kevin. And we'll talk to you all again next week.
That sounds great, Jeff. Have a good week.
You too, bud.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, I don't know where time goes, but obviously it's flying when we're having fun. Special thanks this week to Bing Walder from Cerulean Associates. Really interesting conversation about open multiple employer plans and the perceptions around offering retirement benefits. It's a theme that we've discussed on and on, and we will continue to discuss on this program probably until, gosh, who knows. And thanks, of course, to our contributors from academia, financial services, and the media. Really appreciate their input. And thank you to you, the audience. Thanks for joining us. We look forward to having you back next week. We've got more great guests. And you can have your weekend back. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And we'll talk to you right here next week, right here on the Weekly Pulse.